What I'd like to do is invite some of the staff who are poets, or if they're afraid to call themselves poets, they call themselves poetry lovers. So I'm going to invite some of them to help us kick off the evening. I think Michael and Angela are going to do something for us, and Bruce has got something, and I'll be doing something, and Catherine. So the four of us will kind of, or the five of us will kind of get things started, and then just feel free to keep it flowing and come up. How many people brought something to read, by the way? Whether it's your own or just a handful? Okay. So if there's, so since there's not a lot of people that have something to read, if there's a few that you want to do, feel free to do more than one then, since we don't have tons of people. So thanks for coming. And Michael and Angela, would you like to start us off this evening?
Do you want to say something about whether people want to read up there from their chairs?
Oh, sure. If you do want to just read from your seat, that's fine too. The other microphones around the room will pick up for recording purposes. But for sort of a performance feeling, feel free to come up here at the mic too. So.
The poem that I'm going to read is written by William Stafford, and I chose it because it relates so well to life here at Folded. It's called Walking West. Anyone with quiet pace who walks a gray road in the west may hear a badger underground, where in deep flint another time is caught by flint and held forever. The quiet pace of God stops still. Anyone who listens walks on time that dogs him single file to mountains that are far from people, the face of the land gone gray like flint. Badgers dig their little lives there. Quiet pace, the land lies gaunt. The railroad dies by a yellow depot. Town falls away toward a muddy creek. Badger gray, the sod goes under a river of wind, a hawk on a stick.
Now, Angela and I are going to read a Rainier Maria Rilke poem. And fortunately, we were able to find a book that has the translation both in German and in English. So Angela's going to read a line in German, and then I'll read the line in English, and that way you'll be able to hear the original as well as the translation. And hopefully you will enjoy this.
Ich lebe mein Leben in Wachsen den Ringen.
I live my life in growing orbits.
Die sich über die Dinge ziehen.
Which move out over the things of the world.
Ich werde den letzten vielleicht nicht vollbringen.
Perhaps I can never achieve the last.
Aber versuchen will ich ihn.
But that will be my attempt.
Ich preise um Gott und den uralten Turm.
I am circling around God, around the ancient tower.
Und ich preise Jahrtausende lang.
And I have been circling for 1,000 years.
Und ich weiß noch nicht, bin ich ein Falke, ein Sturm, oder ein großer Gesang.
And I still don't know if I am a falcon, or a storm, or a great song.
Nice.
I'm going to read one other Rilke poem. I really love Rilke because just some things I've learned about him recently is that he had a rather stern mother who locked him in the attic. And a rather sad childhood, and he was also, even though he was a rather sensitive young man, he was put into a military academy. And so these are some of the struggles that he dealt with. He really dove down deep into himself, and a lot of his poems have imagery of God that's connected with darkness and roots, and something I can identify with. So. I love the dark hours of my being, in which my senses drop into the deep. I have found in them, as in old letters, my private life, that is already lived through and become wide and powerful now, like legends. Then I know that there is room in me for a second huge and timeless life. But sometimes I am like the tree that stands over a grave, a leafy tree, fully grown, who has lived out that particular dream that the dead boy, around whom its warm roots are pressing, lost through his sad moods and his poems. Okay, the last poem that I'm going to read is one that I wrote based on experience here at Holden. It's called Garbology Imminent. And I read the first verse of this, and I wasn't quite done with it at our last poetry, and now I've since finished it. And this poem is dedicated to Michelle Braley, who is our former garbologist, and to all garbologists for the hard work that they do. And thanks to Angela and Eric and Catherine for helping me with it.
Tell them
where
it's appearing.
Oh, it's also going to be published in the next edition of Good Courage, I think.
Yep.
So, this is Garbology Imminent. As I slipped my hands in the heavy canvas gloves, still laden with memories of uncertain juices, my fingers considered hidden nests of angry grit. I grimaced and shook them out. This soiling of hands comes first in the communion of waste. And I realized that in the glove is insight latent, garbology imminent. Squeamish, faltering, I fingered the butts of cigarettes while sifting ash into buckets. Pointed out the lips once there, or here. Imagine words last mouthed or tangy smoke breathed. Wondered whose hand touched this, made this waste. We saw the cardboard boxes smashed, flattened, crushed in a big box crusher, bound with wire and lugged to the dock, later to be trucked up to the third level dump and chucked into a corrugated pipe that's open at the ends and stuffed chock full of bundles, there to wait for the barge down lake. Those box bundles minded me of infant coffins, both boxish and built for delicate cargo, used once and tossed, used and let go. At the village edge is the garbage dock, where we pick through plastic bags for bits of trash, unsorted or misplaced. Misplaced trash. I laughed at that, at what we found. Treasures in waste. A bead, a bra, a watch, all broken or botched, left behind or forgotten. A child's painting, or love letters lost, with envelopes intact, like us, in fact, like us. Certainly such secrets, what we toss, make us no longer strangers. At this I had to laugh. In smoldering heaps, some secrets are fired. In the hot breath of furnace, they transform, they become ash particulate. Intricate sculptures of foil and wire, or toxic unknown crust. What has become ashes is now dust. Letters to ashes to dust, which we now breathe in the hot August air. What is not burned is buried deep, asleep in poison pockets of the earth. Curious collections accumulate from Holden's hearth. Gum sole sandal, aerosol, a Polaroid, a shoe. Razor blades and batteries. A half-full jar of Elmer's glue. A mirror cracked. Crucifix. A bag of melted candle wax. We sorted them with puzzled looks and giggled some until we packed them in a metal can marked landfill. In the ash-filled air, I saw a cycle. Endlessly pure or potently tainted. Subtle and silent as cedar roots or vapor rising. Trees leaf to blank sheet, words inspired, now smoke on breath. Life's transformations cross our lips not once or twice, but always. Words, ash, breath, plastic, acid, arsenic, death. Out and in and again. The waste consumes us as we consume the earth. But insight is lost. Perhaps the compost can absolve us, I asked, miss fetid fumes, or try. I confess its rankness made me cry. So sour, so sweet. Melon rinds and onions, spinach leaves and leeks. The cottage cheese, the cantaloupes. Porcelain white, and orange, and verdant green, such mixtures of textures. Rotten and rotting, rich hummus, ash-fed, feeding the soil, a blessing forgotten that we should heed. This life so ripe is resurrection, Christ indeed. So what is this that we call trash? What is given and received? What's buried will come back to us in tree, word, food, breath. With shovel in hand, I fed the earth, as does the eternal garbage man, who associates with waste and asks, who helps me find what has been lost in ash, dirt, or abundant dust?
Well, this was Easter at a friend's house, John and Joanna's, and well, I'll just start. We had an Easter dinner at John's house on Irving, a big sit-down meal at daytime on Irving, for me anyway. I like to eat later. I took some roast lamb, a couple of potatoes, and carried my plate outside to the lawn to a table covered in bright pink chiffon. I had a few beers and a glass of Chablis, and before eating thought, I might want to pee. I stepped back inside the hall to the toilet. The door creaked behind me. John needed to oil it. Unzipping my fly, I gazed in the bowl and spotted a turd there, a huge Tootsie Roll. The thing was gigantic, all coiled and massive. I flushed the John, but this turd was impassive. It budged and it bobbed, but the large stool remained after the water had spiraled and drained. The stew was the largest that I had ever seen. It looked like a log or a toy submarine. I flushed it again, and the action repeated. The feces remained while the water retreated. Someone came to the door then. They knocked and they pounded. "Just a second," I cried, panic-struck and dumbfounded. "A bowel movement's normal," my mother once said, past tense. "Everyone has them. Why, even the president." But something this big was beyond comprehension. "I'm coming," I yelled. It was my sole intention to get rid of this turd. But how could I do it? I said to myself, how if I flew it out of the window? But to my dismay, the guests were all eating just 10 yards away. If I did it, they'd look up from their plate, and in no time would gather around this big turd. And meanwhile, I'd rather say, this wasn't my doing. It isn't my stool. No one would believe me. They'd think me a fool. They'd look at me funny and think I was lying. Why toss a turd if it ain't even mine? "Just a second," I shouted, a plunger in hand. I took the handle and tried to disband this turd into bits. I broke it and then flushed it twice to wash away all the small little shits. I opened the door then to find my friend Janet. While she'd been waiting, she'd eaten a whole pomegranate. "It's about time," she said. And I left that room thinking, the person who left that huge turd in there stinking didn't mind, so why am I here shrinking? I picked up my fork and returned to the table, but I couldn't help but look around and look at who might be capable. I wish I could say this was my creation, but it wasn't. It comes from National Public Radio and was transcribed.
I have a hard act to follow. My name's Catherine. I'm going to read four poems that I wrote. This is my last full day here at Holden, so it's kind of a big event for me, but I'm grateful to Erica for helping arrange this so that it could still happen while I was still here, so that I could share some more poetry with you all. The first one I'm going to read I wrote about 7 months ago when I was traveling through South Africa. And I wrote it when we were driving through an area that used to be a homeland during the apartheid years. It's called Crossing the Transkei. We are driving away from the sun. I cannot describe the color of green in these hillsides, the intricate formations of the clouds. We drive through the valley of the shadow of bondage. But despite changes in government, paperwork, emancipations, the sun doesn't reach this side of the hill slope. I cannot fathom this way of life. Groups of people gathered along the side of the road, just walking from countryside to more countryside. Round huts fashioned of sticks and cow dung, the roofs thatched, the dwellings painted bright teals and oranges. Women of remarkable strength carrying buckets of water on their heads, Lord knows how many miles. I cannot describe the color of life in these people. Don't have the right words for a nation of beauty still wrapped in fear. We are driving through an atmospheric valley, lightning flashing on the left, the road we're driving opening to the Crayola sky blue sky on the right. We are on the fault line, where rain showers us in a baptism for this new nation, for our new lives. We will never be the same after this. This next one I wrote for a friend of mine who was with me on this trip, and ever since January, we've written letters to each other very faithfully, and she's been a very influential friend in my life and a great blessing. So this is called Momentum, and it's for Carrie. You love to walk with a purpose. You hate lagging behind, moving so slowly that your legs hardly notice it. Together, we forged down unknown streets, unafraid of the supposed dangers we had been warned of in a grief-ridden city. You told me it's liberating to walk without fear. Months have passed since our walks together in foreign lands, and you still welcome me with your quietness and the swift movement of your step. It isn't uncomfortable if we don't speak, though our words are always truthful and easy. When we are back in our native country, you struggle not to let your surroundings conform you back into your old comfortable self, the self that isn't yours anymore. You don't agree with people in this world, those who warn you away from the way you long to live, the way they tried to warn us out of the streets of Johannesburg. Fear not, my beloved, for you are liberated. You can simply be wherever you are, and you will always carry your fearlessness. The next two I'm going to read are fairly new. Just wrote them in the last couple of months. They're both just about the ending of summer. The first one is called Extending. You say we can suspend time, keep the month of June from closing in around us. At midsummer, we embrace the length of the day with arms extended to hold on to the June winds that blow right through us, arms that try to grasp the sun before it nestles its way into the westward mountains. We are suspended here like the solstice, though we dance into evenings that come to us earlier and earlier. I refuse to be ruled by the seasons, open my arms wide to deny the close of day. You tell me June can last forever if only we believe it strongly enough. We clutch to these last days of June and refuse to shrink. The last one is called Baptism. You tell me I should write a poem about eternal life, calling it the life that has no end. But I'd rather write about water, about these bridges we cross as we walk together. You say you've known people who fear log beams without handholds, who have to be persuaded to follow trails that face danger in crossing water. The fierceness of rushing streams can define who we are to each other, separate the risk takers from those who are afraid to trust when the water below is too deep and foaming to show the jagged rocks beneath. If you fell from here, you'd be a goner. But maybe the souls and spirits of the risk takers live on, rushing with the waters. And those of the leery hang dangling from the crags and corners of bridges, clutching on, living on. We walk single file over this bridge, balancing ourselves as precariously as we gauge the words we say to each other, and pausing wide-eyed to watch the life in the water beneath us.
Erica Ray. I've been here since September, and I didn't do nearly as much writing as I intended to do. I had grand plans of doing lots and lots of writing, and I didn't. So instead, what I did was reworked a lot of rough journal writings. So I'm going to start off with a couple of things that I don't think I've ever read to a group before, and I like doing that, even though it's a little scary. So this is a poem that I wrote. It's actually called a prose poem, and I'd never tried to write one of these until I took a poetry course over a year ago. And it's basically like a paragraph of prose. It doesn't have any poem form to it, but I wrote this for my grandma. My grandma taught me to play solitaire at the table that seated 12. Without speaking, we'd shuffle and slap them down in the lantern-lit kitchen at the cabin up north. The lanterns didn't hiss out until after the last moonlight trip to the outhouse. And then Grandma was up again before the morning stars had faded, starting in on that old red pump with a vigor she reserved just for that breakfast water. Oh, she was very no-nonsense, raised 11 Catholic children, baked cakes every day for supper's dessert. She was too busy with the aunties to catch us teasing the Venus flytrap plant with the flittery tips of our thin fingers. However, thumping down the staircase on our butts was a game that we were warned repeatedly would wear out the carpet and Grandma's patience. Her firm reprimands came in a voice that was feathery light, like her waved hair, which never turned white. She noticed from her hospital bed when my own hair changed to teenager bleach blonde, but that was the last thing she would ever know of her granddaughter. I learned later that just before she died, she told Great Auntie Frances that the Virgin Mary was there in the corner waiting for her. My grandma's name was Mary Lorraine, and she wore faded flowered house dresses with hankies and rosaries in the pockets. I think that Holden doesn't have very many outlets for sensuality, and so I'm going to read a poem called Declaration of Desire. My declaration of desire. I want to be the sweetheart. I want my sheets to tangle round two bodies. I want another flesh puzzle piece, maneuvering the tips and dips before the closing of legs and eyes, when I want someone to tell me I'm a petaled darling and that I make birds in his dream. I want to wake up with bliss on my breath, and I want someone to taste the bitter, broken, rising sweet of me, the scared, scarred, soft spot of me. I want to wear the friction of another life passion igniting my own, and I want to hit someone's blaze button. I want to stride into a mutual exclamation of electric admiration, into a tight braid of trust and lust and kindness, into respect spelled out in song, in marble, in paint. I want someone to lick me till I shine. I want someone to love the tiny hair of my body and to love his. I want to be the precious, startling star in your sky, baby, the sweetheart star. And I read this one at the last poetry reading, so maybe a few of you have heard it, but it's my favorite thing that I've written, so I'll do it again. It's called Grounded, and I wrote this last summer when I was having a really tough time in Minneapolis, and so I took advantage of going to visit a friend that lives in Chicago, so I was fleeing off away. Grounded.
When I find myself stuck in a slow motion, melancholy muck, doing an achy self-conscious, pulling my emotional muscles, funk in the pain-tangled, love-mangled city in my face, memory dangling off of every place, when I find myself like this, I want to be displaced. Hitch on an eastbound cumulus or a flappy little tail of a storm cloud and just let myself drip drop down through the lazy horizontal arms of afternoon gathering. Just lay myself splat flat down on a Wisconsin farm with my body 100 acres stretching, where the tallest things are cottonwood, steeple, silo, sky, and dragonfly, where the noisiest things are legato wavelengths of landscape and liquid sound waves of river, where the only problems to muddle through are solved in chewing cud, hoofing mud, and getting the last moo. Oh, here may my head be filled with dark dirt content. Here may I wear this solace like a chiffon leaf, and may my old grief be dislodged by boulders. May the corn silk curl comfort round my shoulder, and may the petty child of jealous mind be eclipsed by clover, and all the bicker brain chatter be hushed, and may I sink lower. Till me, fill me, plow me through, plant me deep, weed me, seed me, roust me out, sprout me in, flood me, flip me, wash me down, sunny side up, and I am grounded. Thanks.
First of all, I have to say I have never heard such erudite testimonials to garbage and poop. Outstanding. My name's Bob Colburn, and I am from Edina Community Lutheran Church in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And I put together a poem that was done particularly for a departing interim pastor. She was with us for 3 years as an interim pastor. That's because we had quite a time with our call committee getting a new pastor. In fact, three members of that call committee are here at Holden now, recuperating. 3 years to find another highly motivated, extremely intelligent woman co-pastor, because that was our mandate. So during those 3 years, this interim pastor, Cindy Jerpy, H-J-E-R-P-E, Cindy Jerpy, was our pastor, was our one of our co-pastors. Now, she just left us last Sunday because we have our new one coming in now. And this goes for her. I don't know how it went. I wasn't there. I was on my way here. But I wrote this for her. And keep in mind, I guess, Dr. Seuss. That'll help you get the feeling of this poem. It's called A Letter's a Letter Unless It's a J. I never know quite what to say when a word comes along with the letter J. Sometimes it's a Y, sometimes it's H. Why can't a J be a J every day? There are 12 different ways this letter's misused. No wonder it seems to be lost and confused. The problem's compounded, and I try to place blame when that elusive letter J turns up in a name. When your friend sends a note that he's bought a new Jeep, Do you smile? Say how nice that you're driving a heap? Take Jesus, for instance. Now that J's sensible use. Till someone exclaims and says, no, no, it's Jesus. Well, the day was quite frightening when Cindy came here. Her last name caused panic and trembling and fear. Just how should I say hello or goodbye? Was it jerpy or herpy or yerpy? Oh, my. I was caught once again on a dilemma's horn. What did they call her on the day she was born? Was it Swedish, Norwegian, Danish, or Finn? I looked at her last name again and again, and I fretted and stewed, wondering just what to say. When she just took my hand in a most friendly way, and she said with a twinkle, oh, just Cindy will do. You'll know who I am, and I'll always know you.
I might as well be perfect. That my daughter nudging me, and I'm just going to sit here. Just sit and be quiet. This is from this book that I'm sure all of you have seen. When I am an old woman, I shall wear purple. Because I'm at a stage in my life that I know I'm going to be an old woman before I know it. It's just going to sneak up. It happens. So I'm finally reading this book instead of just looking at it. And there's two in here. And one is called More Advice by Joanne Seltzer. And I was just reading these today going up on the boat, so they're kind of fresh for me. It's called More Advice. Have a daughter to mother talk. Ask her what she wants. If she doesn't know, ask her if she's happy. She will either say she doesn't know or she will be silent. Tell her how much you love her. Promise you won't forsake her. And this one I just love, and it's got this great picture. Sorry. I could say it. I just love that lady. It's called Social Security by Barbara Bolts. I think that's how I pronounce her name. No, James. She knows a cashier who blushes and lets her use food stamps to buy tulip bulbs and rose bushes. We smile each morning as I pass her, her hand always married to some stick or hoe or rake. One morning I shout, I'm not skinny like you, so I've got to run 2 miles each day. She begs me closer, whispers to my flesh, all you need, honey, is to be on welfare and love roses.
Couple of poems I wrote. They're kind of old, but I happen to have them with me, so. I've noticed that lately you've been looking at the darkness so intensely, forgetting about the bright values, bursting forth in scattered patterns, gazing at the night. And when I looked into your soul last night, I saw you leaping and feeling the rain, and then you placed a jar over you, the wetness splashing against the glass, drip, drip, drop. Sad eyes looking out with a curious fear. And I saw your essence clotting, and I tried to make you swallow it or spit it out, or, and I swam in your vacant eyes, and I saw the truth written plainly across your cornea. I saw the sadness etched firmly, and I took your hand, and I lifted your eyelids to whisper into them, for a scream would shatter them. And I repeated myself for months, until today, you looked at my smile and remembered. This one kind of needs an introduction. I switched schools from a private school, which I had been going to Catholic schools all my life, to a public school, and I saw my first fight ever end. There was a lot of blood, and it scared me a lot, and it made me really sad, and I wrote this poem. It's called Ahimsa is Nonviolence in Action, Thought, and Word. This burning rage, this inner unrest, bursting forth in brighter than white flashes, glaring at every eye that cares to glance. Many of you have developed your light-resistant shields over the years, so it will not burn. How was I to know that mine was outdated? How was I to know how far your world had advanced? How was I to know how far your world had digressed? It pierces me, and the fright and anger and sadness overcomes me in tsunamis. It rushes over the quiet pastures of all my past perceptions of the human morals and hearts. I cry out and learn that now I am the shocking one. And then I'm going to read one by Seamus Heaney. It's called At the Wellhead. Your songs, when you sing them with your two eyes closed, as you always do, are like a local road we've known every turn of in the past. That midge-veiled, high-heeled side road where you stood, looking and listening until a car would come and go and leave you lonelier than you had been to begin with. So sing on, dear shut-eyed one, dear far-voiced veteran. Sing yourself where the singing comes from, ardent and cut off like our blind neighbor, who played the piano all day in her bedroom. Her notes came out to us like hoisted water, raveling off a bucket at the wellhead, where next thing we'd be listening, hushed and awkward. That blind from birth, sweet voice, withdrawn musician was like a silver vein in heavy clay, night water glittering in the light of day, but also just our neighbor, Rosie Keenan. She touched our cheeks, she let us touch her braille, in books like books wallpaper patterns come in. Her hands were active and her eyes were full of open darkness and a watery shine. She knew us by our voices. She'd say she saw whoever or whatever. Being with her was intimate and helpful, like a cure you didn't notice happening. When I read a poem with Keenan's will in it, she said, I can see the sky at the bottom of it now.
My name is Paul Tweed. I came up on Friday. I'm here with my parents, Harvey and Frances Tweed. It's their 50th anniversary year. And so Mother wanted me to do this. But I know you don't have telephones here at Holden Village, but for those of you who haven't been up here too long, you know that in the outside world there are such things, and there are these things called answering services. And I'm a music teacher. And my answering service is sort of my secretary, so I don't want to have just a regular humdrum answering service, so I'm going to share a few of them with you. And I'm also a singer, so I don't just speak into them, I sing them. So one of the first ones I thought of was this. Do, the phone, no, we're not home. Ray, I wish we could be here. Me, this is the Tweet residence. Fa will not be gone too long, so please leave your name and number. La, a message if you wish. T, just listen for the beep, and we'll get right back to you. We'll happily return your... Now, for those of you who are pianists, violinists, trumpeters, whatever, you know that the whole repertoire is at your disposal. If there's a piece of music that's written for you as a violinist, you can learn to play it. But if you're a singer, you're stuck with the stuff that is appropriate for your voice. So being a baritone, I hear all these wonderful things for tenors and sopranos that I can't sing. So I've sort of taken care of this dilemma with my answering service, and this is my answer to the laughing song from Die Fledermaus. You are calling, ah ha ha, we are stalling, ah ha ha, for we are not near the phone. Please listen for the tone. Leave a message and your name, and we will return the same. Yes, we will get back to you. course, holiday times are always a wonderful time for doing something creative. And being a good Lutheran, I thought this one would be appropriate. For unto us the phone is ringing, but we can't come to the phone. So please listen for the tone and leave your message with your number. And then this was one I've had on quite recently, though it was on for a long time. And it's probably one of the shortest ones that my in-laws very much appreciate, the shortest ones. They live close by and they call all the time and they hear these many, many times. It's just left my head. It's the can-can from Offenbach. We are not at the phone now. Listen for the tone now, and please leave your message, name, and number at the beep.
Isn't creativity great? I listen to all these poems, and something that I've always kind of believed is that, God, I view God as like the original creator. He created all of this world and this place, and the fact that he's given us the ability to create, I think, lets us be like him sometimes. So I love creativity because it lets me escape into my playful mind. So I've got a couple of pieces to share with you today. And it came to be in the days of old, when the town and all its people were ruled by a king. And one fine autumn day, the king called out to his servants, "Go out and find me a man worthy to come before me to dance and sing." And so the servants, they went far beyond the hills, and they searched for the man with the bells on his shoes. And he goes by the name of the Jester. A dancing, juggling circus clown, amusement his universal game. And he goes on from town to town, the Jester loves to entertain. And the castle becomes alive when the Jester has arrived, and he is greeted by the king with fine wine and royalty. And when he pulls out his dancing shoes, a chilling silence fills the room, for the show is about to begin. On his face, a twisted grin. It's the smile of the Jester. Tambourine around the knee to keep his arms and legs free, playing all the instruments he can. One man band, he's got a street corner stand. Man, and you should hear this cat play. Blues hop, slide guitar, plays into the passing cars till people stop and watch for a while. Freak show in the road, blowing your mind with all he knows. Throw some change and leave with a smile for the one man band.
Stuff in there. No, I can hear you from it. next to me, and also see that guy over on the other side, so she can hear you.
Okay, this is called Sickens by Shelmer's.
Shelmer's.
Mm-hmm. And it's called Sick. I cannot go to school today, said little Maggie and Mookie. I have the measles, I have the mumps. I gashed and rashed and purple bumps. My mouth is wet, my throat is dry. I'm going blind in my right eye. My tonsils are big as rocks. I counted 16 chicken pox. There's one more. That's 17. And don't you think my face looks green? My legs are cut, my eyes are blue. I might be in stomatic flu. I coughed and sneezed, gasped and choked. I'm sure that my left leg is broke. My hip hurts when I move my chin. My belly button caves in. My back is
wrenched.
My ankle's sprained. My appendix pains each time it rains. My nose is cold, my toes are numb. I have a silver thumb. My neck is stuffed. My spine is weak. I hardly whisper when I speak. My tonsils are filled up my mouth. I think my hair is falling out. My elbows bent. My spines aren't straight. My temper is 108. My brain is shrunk. I cannot hear. There is a hole inside my ear. I have pain nails and my heart is... What? What's that? What's that you say? You say today is Saturday? Bye, I'm going out to play.
I have one short poem by Thomas Merton, who was a Cistercian monk. He lived in a monastery in Kentucky. He died in 1969. He had a brother who was killed in World War II, and this poem that I'm going to read is dedicated to him. It's called For My Brother, Reported Missing in Action, 1943. Sweet brother, if I do not sleep, my eyes are flowers for your tomb. And if I cannot eat my bread, my fasts shall live like willows where you died. If in the heat I find no water for my thirst shall turn to springs for you, poor traveler. Where, in what desolate and smoky country, lies your poor body, lost and dead? And in what landscape of disaster has your unhappy spirit lost its road? Come, in my labor find a resting place, and in my sorrows lay your head, or rather take my life and blood and buy yourself a better bed, or take my breath and take my death, and buy yourself a better rest. When all the men of war are shot, and flags have fallen into dust, your cross and mine shall tell men still, Christ died on each for both of us. For in the wreckage of your April, Christ lays slain, and Christ weeps in the ruins of my spring, the money of whose tears shall fall into your weak and friendless hand, and buy you back to your own land, the silence of whose tears shall fall like bells upon your alien tomb. Hear them and come. They call you home.
Okay, I'm David, and I think I've got like 2 or 4 poems that I'm gonna read from here. First one's called I Must Remember from Shel Silverstein. I must remember turkey on Thanksgiving, pudding on Christmas, eggs on Easter, chicken on Sunday, fish on Friday, leftovers on Monday. But ah me, I'm such a dunce, I went and ate them all at once. And okay, I lost my page. Okay, I found it. Okay, the second one is Sarah Cynthia Sylvia Stout would not take the garbage out. Sarah Cynthia Sylvia Stout would not take the garbage out. She'd scoured the pots and scraped the pans, candy the yams and spiced the hams. And though her daddy would scream and shout, she simply would not take the garbage out. And so it piled up to the ceilings, coffee grounds, potato peelings, brown bananas, rotten peas, chunks of sour cottage cheese. It filled the cans, it covered the floors, it cracked the windows and blocked the doors. With bacon, with bacon rinds and chicken bones, drippy ends of ice cream cones. Prune pits, peach pits, orange peels, gloppy clumps of cold oatmeal, pizza crust and withered greens, soggy beans and tangerines, crust of black, burned butter toast, grisly bits of beefy roast. The garbage rolled on down the hall, it raised the roof, it broke the wall. Greasy napkins, cookie crumbs, globs of gooey bubble gum, cellophane from green bologna, rubber, blubbery macaroni, peanut butter caked and dry, curdled milk and crust of pies, moldy melons, dried up mustard, eggshells mixed with lemon custard, cold French fries and rancid meat, yellow lumps of cream of wheat. At last the garbage reached so high that it finally touched the sky, and all the neighbors moved away, and none of her friends would come to play. And finally Sarah Cynthia Stout said, okay, I'll take the garbage out. But then of course it was too late. The garbage reached across the state, from New York to the Golden Gate. And there in the garbage she did hate. Poor Sarah met an awful fate that I cannot right now relate, because the hour is much too late. But children remember Sarah Stout and always take the garbage out. Okay, I'm gonna read Peanut Butter Sandwich next. I'll sing you a poem of a silly young kid who played with the world at the end of a string, but he only loved one single thing, and that was just a peanut butter sandwich. His scepter and his royal gowns, his regal throne and golden crowns were brown and sticky from the mounds and drippings from each peanut butter sandwich. His subjects all were silly fools, for he had passed a royal rule that all that they could learn in school was how to make peanut butter sandwich. He would not eat his sovereign steak, he scorned his soup, a keenly cake, and told his courtly cook to bake an extra sticky peanut butter sandwich. Then one day he took a bite and started chewing with delight, but found his mouth was stuck quite tight from that last bite of peanut butter sandwich. His brother pulled, his sister pried, The wizard pushed his mother and cried, "My boy's committed suicide from eating his last peanut butter sandwich." The dentist came and the royal doc, the royal plumber banged and knocked, but still those jaws stayed tightly locked. Oh darn that sticky peanut butter sandwich. The carpenter, he tried with pliers. The telephone man tried with wires. The firemen, they tried with fire, but could not melt that peanut butter sandwich. With ropes and pulleys, drills and coil, with steam and lubricating oil, for 20 years of tears and toil, they fought off that awful peanut butter sandwich. Then all his royal subjects came. They hooked his jaws with grappling chains and pulled both ways with might and main against that stubborn peanut butter sandwich. They hooked his jaws. No, I don't. Okay, each man and woman, girl and boy, put down their plows and pots and toys and pulled until, crack, oh joy, they broke right through that peanut butter sandwich. A puff of dust, a squeak, the king's jaws opened with a creak. And then in a voice so faint and weak, the first words they heard him speak were, "How about another peanut butter sandwich?" Okay. I have to enjoy. Okay, this one's called, I got one more after this one. This one's called The Long-Haired Boy. There was a boy in our town with long hair. I mean really long hair. And everybody pointed at him and laughed at him and made fun of him. And when he walked down the street, the people would roar and stick their tongues out and make funny faces and run in and slam the door and shout at him from the window until he couldn't stand it anymore. So he sat down and cried till his whole body shook, and pretty soon his hair shook too. And it flapped and it flapped, and he lifted and flew straight up in the air like a helicopter. Jenny Rick saw him and dropped her knitting and screamed, "It's a flying kid!" Lukey Hastings ran and hid under old man Merrill's car. Miss Terrence fainted. Henry Quist tried to shoot him down, but missed. "I thought he was a crow," he said. And round he sailed all through the day, smiling in the strangest way. With the wind in his hair and the sun in his eyes, we swooped to him. We saw him swoop and bank and rise. He brushed the treetops and skimmed the grass on Yerby's lawn and almost crashed right into Hanson's silo, but zoomed up in time and almost hit the courthouse. Old man Cooley bit right through his napkin when he saw a kid flying through the diner door and out of the window, tipping the ladder where Smokey was painting. He almost had a heart attack. He clung to a rafter. The kid flew on, us running after, cheering and sweating and screaming, "Hooray!" Mayor Lowry shouted, "Hey, come down here, kid. We'd like to say how proud of you we are today." Whoever thought our little town would have a hero in it? So I'd like to proclaim this day, "Hey, kid, will you please come down for just a minute?" The flying kid could not come down. He treaded air above the town, sort of crying and looking down at all of us here on the ground. Then he flew up into the clouds, flapping and flying so far and high, out past the hills and into the sky, until a tiny speck of against the sun was all we could see of him, and then he was gone. And the last one I'm going to read from Shel Silverstein is called Lazy Jane, and it goes, "Lazy, lazy, lazy Jane." No, I don't remember. I can't remember how she. Let's go to the book. I thought I remembered it. Okay, I can find it. It's like, fine. So, uh-oh. Can I not find it? Uh-oh. Okay, there it is. Lazy, 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 lazy Jane. She wants a drink of water, so she waits and 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 waits for it to rain.
Anyone else have a poem? Well, thank you so much for coming and sharing.
Could I just make a quick announcement?
Uh-huh.
Well, here at this place at 9 o'clock on Wednesday, this very room.
PM Bill? Or AM?
Mm-hmm.
AM or PM?
Oh, PM.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.
There'll be a video, a movie of a peace walk that took place in 1986 from Los Angeles to Washington, D.C., called the Great Peace March. And it was 1,200 people walking and camping across the country for global nuclear disarmament. I was on the peace walk. I'll be talking a little bit about it and also showing the video. It's not going to be announced in the village. It's just basically word of mouth. So if you're interested, show up.
Wednesday at 9 o'clock.
This Wednesday.
This Wednesday.
Night.
This room?
Yeah.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.